So before you went to Colorado, do you remember where you played your first job in Minnesota as Joey Strobel and the Runaways?
Yeah, that was Papa Joe's. It was in West Broadway. It was on North Minneapolis. First night we got there.
It was called the Northern Bar.
Was it the Northern?
Well, Papa Joe's Northern A-Go-Go, right?
Yeah. Well, we just...
call it Papa Joe's.
We call it Papa Joe's.
The sign on the outside of the building said Northern Bar.
Northern Bar?
Yeah, I think that you're right there. They said Northern Bar.
Hold it. Now, this is... Papa Joe's is before or after Colorado?
This was after Colorado.
After Colorado.
Yeah, after Colorado.
So I have your first night as St. Patrick's Day, 1965. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think it was St. Patrick's Day because we had like 3 feet of snow and there was nobody in the place. You know, and we just hung around and talked around, but we played anyway, you know. And it was almost like I remembered when we were empty when they had that Cuban crisis thing. We had some more bad luck. But everybody liked the band. The way the bartenders liked the band, the waitresses that were there said, "You guys are very good." Joe seemed real happy. And that weekend we had a good, very good business, and we stayed there for a while.
So I'm showing the address of Papa Joe's, also known as Papa Joe's Northern Bar, as 323 West Broadway.
And Joe's last name was Daskowitz. Joe Daskowitz.
And Joe...
Yeah, he wasn't Italian.
And Joe's last name was Joe Daskowitz. And after your job at Papa Joe's, I understand you switched to a club on Hennepin Avenue, correct?
Yes, called the Pink Pussycat, owned by Marvin Goldman.
What do you recall about the Pink Pussycat, Joey?
Well, it was a nice club when we got there. It was small, and Marvin was a very nice man. He had a good sense of humor. We were very crowded, so he was real happy with us. In fact, he knocked out a wall. There was a wall. It was a smaller place, and he knocked out a wall later on and built a big stage for us because it was too big. And I remember one night, on a Saturday night, we let there were some photographers there, taking a bunch of pictures for, and I said, well, who are these guys? And Marv said, they're from the Star Tribune. We're going to be in the picture section. They didn't say anything about the cover, but they said the picture section. So we were smiling. A good thing we had a good crowd that night because they were all moving around, taking pictures and everything. In fact, the next day, I made a call to see if I could get some copies of that picture, but they told me no, and I was kind of surprised and said, well, why is that? They said, well, we're having some problems. We're kind of being sued because I guess there were a lot of people dancing down there with partners who they really weren't supposed to be with, and they were very discreet about what they said, of course, and we got the picture right away and started laughing.
And I understand one night a local songwriter paid a visit to the Pink Pussycat to see your band, and his name was Bill Normandin.
Yes, that's correct. We had been at the Pink Pussycat for a while, and I had seen him earlier. He just come in. He was kind of a fan, liked the band. But him and another guy by the name of Tony Peronto got together and wrote a song, and he showed it to me. And I thought it had possibilities. It sounded pretty good. I liked the change of tempo in it. It needed some kind of an arrangement as far as the horns. And we were talking about it. Marv Goldman said he'd be interested in me. He said, well, that would be a good promotion to promote the club if we had a record. You know, he knows some people. He produced it pretty much, you know, paid for the recording and stuff and knew some people who would play it. And we arranged it, added the horn section in the front and a pause and a break in the center, in the middle of it. And it got a lot of play.
So this becomes the A-side of a 45 on the Bear label in early 66, and the song is What Good Is Love.
That's correct.
And what's on the B-side?
Oh, Sax Shuffle. Bobby Rockwell, who was an excellent tenor saxophone player, also played baritone. And we said we have to play something. We didn't want to play somebody else's material, so him and I got together. And it's just a riff. It's a nice riff, and... we produced what we call Sax Shuffle, because it featured the his ability to play sax, which was excellent. And that got some airplay. In fact, I heard that sometimes more than I heard What Good Is Love.
So according to the chart you provided, the song, What Good Is Love, charts on KDWB, hits number 35 on May 7, 1966.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yeah. I had one that was up a little higher, but that's neither here nor there, I guess.
Bear Label was Lieberman.
Oh.
Don't know. That was kind of Marv's department, Marvin Goldman.
Now, Denny Johnson came into possession of a live recording at the Pink Pussycat. Do we know if that was recorded by Mike Jan?
Yes, it was.
So a local fan, Mike Jan, recorded your band on January 18, 1967. Let's run through the songs. How Could I Forget? What do you recall about that song?
I don't even remember that song, to be honest. How Could I Forget?
All right, let's go to the next one.
Fits the title.
And the next song I see is You're So Fine. I'm assuming that's a reworking of the Chiffons' He's So Fine?
Absolutely.
La Bamba?
La Bamba. I did the Spanish part of it, just like he did on the record.
Richie Valens. Okay. Yep. Here in My
Good
Head?
Actually, it's Here in My Heart.
Oh, Here in My Heart.
And
is that a cover song?
That was out, I remember. Here in My Heart.
And I see the next song is Peepin' and Hidin'.
By Lloyd Price, correct.
Okay, I see Memphis is on the list.
Yeah, Memphis, I think Lonnie Mack, Johnny Rivers, I think, used to do that a lot down in New Orleans.
Lonnie Mack did the instrumental and Johnny Rivers did it with words. Which version did you do, though?
Well, I did it with words.
With words.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I see These Arms of Mine by Otis Redding.
We loved Otis Redding. He had that soulful voice, and we did a couple songs by him, you know.
98.6?
That was more of a jump to rock and roll, 98.6. That was a good song. It was on the charts. We played it. We tried to do like songs that we liked, and then we also tried to do songs that were popular to keep the customers happy. If you just play for yourself, you'll have an empty club.
Yep.
So you got to play for the people. So we tried to find a happy medium where we both enjoyed what we did but also made our customers happy.
And also on the list, Hold On, I'm Coming.
Yeah, that was a good song. Sam and Dave did that.
Mustang Sally.
And Wilson Pickett was very popular. We did several songs by him.
You did the Kansas City.
Kansas City, that was a popular song, too.
By
Wilbert
Harrison, Midnight Hour.
And another Wilson Pickett song, Midnight Hour. That was really popular.
Now I understand at some point in early 1968, you found a job over at George's in the Park, 1700 Excelsior Boulevard. What do you recall about going out there?
One night, we were at the Pink Pussycat for quite some time. We knew everybody. I think it was at least 3 years that we were there. And we didn't want to become complacent, so we were kind of had our eyes open for maybe switching. And we looked in the audience one night, and both these guys, George Schomburg and Joe Duffy, were sitting out in the audience in the Pink Pussycat. On a break, they asked me to come over. And George told me about this new club on Excelsior Boulevard called George's in the Park. Would our band be interested in playing out there? That was perfect because we were in a mood for a change. And Marv Goldman was talking about building a new club next, which became the Filling Station. And it was going to be a lapse for a while they got rid of the old place and built a new one. So we agreed and we went out and that was it. We got the job. We ended up staying there for a good 7-8 years. In fact, they gave us a plaque that I have. I brought that.
I understand they had a unique dance floor.
Yes, they did. It was a stainless steel dance floor that had lights all around it, and you could get a good look at everybody from the stage who was out there dancing.
And they had go-go dancers?
No, they didn't have go-go dances at George's. They had go-go dance at the Pink Pussycat, but they had a lot of girls dancing just sometimes with just girls out on a dance floor. They look like go-go dancers, but...
And I understand they had a light show, and I believe you controlled it from the stage, right?
But yes, we did. I had some switches on the floor and a couple in the back. It looked like... You ever see the front of a movie theater when the lights were moving?
A marquee.
It had the marquee effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the show.
And I believe you also played at a club called Duff's on 21 South 8th Street, Minneapolis, correct?
Yes, we played at Duff's for a while.
Now, I understand you met a businessman from Canada at George's in the Park, and he booked you up in Winnipeg, right?
Yes, he did. He was really interested in the group, offered us a good salary to stay up there for a while. We thought it was good to leave George's and, of course, want to come back. And George agreed, yeah, we'll try something different, you know, keep the interest of the people. And we went up there, and we did well up there. He liked us. Oh, the temperature was 30 degrees below zero. We were there up in the winter. It gets pretty cold up in Winnipeg. But we still had good crowds. And we went up there a couple times and played. And he was very happy with us.
So when you're playing at George's in the Park, can you give us an idea of what kind of clothes you wore on stage?
Well, when we first started there, we kind of just dressed individually, but the management wanted us to look alike. So for a while there, I would dress up in a shark. Went out and bought a sharkskin gray suit and a black tie and everything. I felt like a gangster, you know. And the other guys dressed pretty similar to that. You know, being from New York, I had to go around bopping a little bit. But then they wanted a change from that. They wanted something brighter. So they bought us canary yellow outfits to wear.
Suits.
I remember Dick Perner, our saxophone, felt like he looked like Yellow Bird. He said he doesn't even want to play a saxophone in that outfit. So he eventually got rid of that and went to blue, which was a little... a little better, anyway. The guys, they weren't really crazy about those, but
that was the early 70s powder blue.
Yes, it was.
And platform shoes too.
Yeah. Oh, that was in style. I remember when that was, everybody had those. You know,
1970 comes along, the Connie Awards, and Joey Strobel and the Runaways are nominated for Best 21 and Over Band.
Well, we were nominated, but we didn't win. There were a lot of bands nominated.
Right. The winner was the Sir Rawleys, and the other nominees were Big Island, the XL5, Dave Mark Syndicate, Danny's Reasons, and Zarathustra. Now, you went out and saw the XL5, right?
Yes, I did.
At the Cascade 9?
Yeah, we tried to visit some of the other groups who were around. We had Monday nights off after a while, and that was good PR. So we were... It's important to go out and see what your competition is playing too, and get some ideas about you know, you want to keep up with the Joneses attitude.
What kind of crowd did you get at George's in the Park?
Thought it was actually a better class of people out there who lived. You know, and I say better, I don't mean better as far as solar, but better dressed people, more stylish, and a lot of girls. You know, on Tuesdays and Thursdays they had girls' night where you get drinks for half price, and we'd get there they'd start drinking at 7 o'clock at night, and we'd get there at 8:30, and they'd be all ready for the bands, you know, and that would bring in the men and the boys and stuff. George Steinberg was a good promoter. He ran a good club. He didn't spare any money in advertisement. He had a big marquee outside that said Joey Strobel and the Runaways. Looked like a movie theater.
How many people do you think would show up there on a typical weekend night?
Oh, God. I'd say well over 100, 150 people in that room.
Now, according to my records, you are booked at the Filling Station, April 29, 1971. That's at 1401 Hennepin. And this is the brand new club built by Marv Goldman after the Pink Pussycat closed, correct?
That's correct.
What do you recall about the Filling Station?
Well, when Marv Goldman had some problems, which I'm not sure all the details, when that club first opened up, and he never really got off the ground as far as, you know, business. He tried a bunch of different bands, and it wasn't as popular as the Pink Pussycat. Anyway, he came and asked if we'd be interested in playing there for a while, because we did well there, and everybody knew us. We had a lot of success out of George's in the Park, and we left George's at the Park just to go down there, and we played there, but we were there like just for a few weeks, and we just couldn't get the business we used to have.
Do you recall Judy Happy playing at the piano bar there?
No, I don't.
Okay, so it looks like you're back at George's in the Park in September of 71, and then in summer of 72, you're at the Hopkins House. Do you recall the Hopkins House?
Yes, I do. That was just some gigs, you know, one-nighters here and there. Maybe play a week at a time.
Now, according to my records, in 1974, there was a change in owners at George's in the Park, and it became Duff's in the Park.
Yes, there was a legal problem that they had. They were partners, and I don't know all the details, but it did become Duff's in the Park, and we stayed there for a while. And then when we left, we worked at Joe Duffy's Club downtown.
Duff's
downtown for a while. After some months there, we started moving around. Just there was just no, we didn't have the business things. Things were changing, you know, the music scene was changing down in Minneapolis. We didn't have the crowds anymore that we had at the Pink Pussycat or at George's. There were more and more bands, and the horn sections that we had weren't as popular as they were during those years that we had Joey Strubel and the Runaways.
Now, you had three horns at one time, right?
Yes, we did. Tenor saxophone, a trombone, and a trumpet.
Now, Joe Duffy also owned another club called Duffy's on 26 and 26, Southeast Minneapolis. Did you ever play there?
No, we didn't. Okay.
Let's talk about your 45 on the Saturday Saint label.
It's still tonight, and it's true. Okay, that was another song written by Tony Peronto.
And Bill Normandin.
It wasn't as popular. I wasn't really crazy about the song when we did it, but we tried to give make it better with an arrangement, and it came out okay, but it got some airplay, and the other side got some airplay, too.